hearing in docket CT05-005 in the matter of the proceeds from bonds and other security for the benefit of customers of S&S Communications. The time is approximately 1 p.m. The date is October 21st, 2008, and the location of the hearing is in room 423, State Capitol Building in Pierce, South Dakota. My name is Gary Hansen. I'm the Commission Chairman. Commissioner Steve Kolbeck and Dustin Johnson, Commissioner Dustin Johnson, are also present. I'm presiding over this hearing. The hearing was noticed pursuant to the Commission's order for and notice of hearing on motions to dismiss and consolidate and motion for summary disposition issued September 15, 2008. The issues at this hearing are, one, whether this case should be dismissed as against Matt Swearingen because of his discharge in bankruptcy, two, whether each complaint should be allowed, denied, dismissed, or consolidated with another complaint, and three, what damages, award, and judgment fraction, if any, each complainant should be entitled to in the event the Commission is able to obtain collection from S&S or its remaining non-discharged general partner on any judgment entered in this case. All parties have the right to be present and to be represented by an attorney. All persons testifying will be sworn in and subject to cross-examination by the parties. The Commission's final decision may be appealed by the parties to the State Circuit Court and State Supreme Court. And with that, we will begin the hearing with Mr. John Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm John Smith, staff attorney on this case. Just maybe a bit of introduction before we jump into the meat of the matter. You'll note it's in the matter of complaints filed by customers of S&S Communications. If you call back, these complaints were filed throughout the latter half, beginning in July through December of 2003. In 2005, staff came before the Commission and requested that these complaints be consolidated. One of the primary reasons for that, one of the reasons is simply practicality and convenience, but a substantive reason is that Chapter 49-13 contemplates that only cases that have been consolidated at the Commission level can be brought as consolidated proceedings at the Circuit Court for entry of judgment. So we wanted to make sure we had the case in the status that it should be in for that purpose. And one of the reasons, as you'll note, one of the key things that results from this proceeding is the arrival of a fractional share for each complainant. And one of the advantages of a consolidated approach is if we are able to find any assets, and again, I don't know that we will. There's certain information that we've received that would indicate that's unlikely. But in the event that happens, in order for the complainants all to be dealt with fairly and not, in effect, having a rush to the courthouse to see who can glom onto what, this process is designed to fairly apportion any proceeds that might be received among the parties in accordance with those fractions. So with that, I'll move along to with me here today, by the way, is Keith Singer. He's a former employee, staff member of the PUC. He recently, about 6 months ago or so, left the PUC and is now an employee of Bureau of Finance and Management. And I do want to both thank Keith for being willing to hang in there with us to see this matter through. I also do want to make it clear that if, Keith, I don't know that we're going to have any testimony here today. We're not really intending to. But he's here not on behalf in any way officially of BF&M, but he's here in his capacity of a former staffer who's agreed to serve in an ad hoc staff capacity to get this done. So just making that clear. With that, as you note, the primary motion that we've made is a motion for summary disposition pursuant to SDCL 12618. It's our basic belief that the really essential facts in this case are not in dispute. We've been through two major proceedings on this already. We've heard the testimony about how S&S collected a whole lot of prepayments from South Dakota customers and from customers in other states, how they got into financial trouble and went out of business in June of 2003, and how they left a lot of customers with a lot of prepaid contracts that remained unfulfilled. After that, as you well know, we went through the Certificate of Authority revocation proceeding in which the commission revoked SNS's certificate, finding they had violated the terms of their basic agreement with the state, and also subjected SNS to fines totaling some $13,400 for a number of violations of commission orders and state statutes. Later, we brought the a proceeding, and that was TC05-047, which was the disposition of bonds and other security proceeds that we were able to recover for the benefit of SNS's customers. We concluded that proceeding, and we mailed out those proceeds totaling $197,000 in July of 2005. Just a word of explanation as to then, okay, why is it now, not 2005, 2007, a little over a year ago. I guess just a word of explanation as to why have we now taken as long as we have to bring the remainder of the case before you. I mean, the bottom line is shortly after the bond proceeds were distributed, I was contacted by the attorney for the last sole remaining partner of SNS, and was advised by him that the remaining partner, L'Assomption, intended to file for bankruptcy. And because of that, it just seemed to me that if that were going to happen, we'd be subject to the automatic stay under the Federal Bankruptcy Act, that we wait, let him file. And if that had occurred, of course, it would have ended the matter, because then everyone concerned would have been discharged. Well, he didn't file right away. Later on in approximately November of 2007, I spoke with counsel for Mr. Assumption again, and he then informed me that due to some other things going on in his life, he would be filing, but he would not be filing until early, sometime in the first few months of 2008. As you well know, we were in the midst of TransCanada during that period anyway. Well, we concluded the TransCanada matter in late April. Still, he hadn't filed. I finally contacted his attorney again in the summer of this year. And basically, I think, the message I got was, you know, you probably should just go ahead and conclude your matter because, he doesn't seem to be getting around to it. And so here we are today to bring this matter to a conclusion before you, to obtain a judgment, to record that judgment, and then to do what we can to search for any assets that might be out there, and if we can find any, to try to recover some money for the complainants. Okay, before I turn to the motion for summary disposition, and again, the preponderance of that will be to establish what complaint amounts complainants are entitled to. There are a couple of cases in the motion where we recommend denial. Both of those two cases are situations where the evidence that we have indicates conclusively that those particular complainants received the full 100% of their prepaid amounts. Those we're recommending denial on. In addition to the those denials, we've got several motions before the commission, a number of them, and I guess maybe I could turn to the chairman or the commission. I did them as individual motions largely because we've tried to pursue a philosophy of relative confidentiality protection for complainants, and also because it is at least possible that the commission would determine that there are enough distinctions between the different situations to warrant different treatment. But one of them was just to keep them separate so we weren't lumping a whole bunch of people together and again, disclosing identities to people. And for whatever reason, the decision was made early on in this process not to reveal complainant names. And subsequently, we've pursued a philosophy here of, generally speaking, not doing that, of of not publicizing complainant names on the web. There is a tremendous amount of highly, highly confidential material in the complaint files themselves. Things such as bank account information, social security numbers. And so we felt it was just better to retain those personal files, very sensitive files, in confidence. And with that, I think I'll turn to the motions. What I thought is some of them may be able to be lumped together to some extent. And I can do that if you like. Otherwise, I think we can breeze through them all pretty quickly and dispose of them. The first one is relates not to complainants, but to it's a motion to dismiss with respect to Matt Swearingen. Mr. Swearingen did file for bankruptcy, and that's one of the reasons we were stayed for quite a while during the pendency of that. In his bankruptcy court, the judge on December 6, 2005, the United States Bankruptcy Court entered an order discharging Matthew Swearingen in that case. You'll note, if you look at the motion, I cite the actual statutory provision that prohibits us from attempting in any way to levy or to collect any form of, to levy any kind of a judgment against him or collect any kind of debt. So all of this is a housekeeping measure to get him out of the case so we're not in violation of federal law.
And Mr. Smith, just so I'm sure I'm clear that I understand this, this is instructive to us is why we waited to find out what was going on with Mr. Sumption, because if he declared bankruptcy, we'd be in the exact same situation where all of this additional paperwork and these legal motions and most of this notice wouldn't have been necessary.
It not only would not have been necessary, but we would have been prohibited by law from proceeding with it. And that's correct, exactly.
Mr. Swearingen made things a lot easier on us, and frankly, the people who were defrauded by S&S, and Mr. Sumption could have done the same thing but hasn't gotten around to it.
He hasn't gotten around to it, yes. I mean, it certainly, again, if you are insolvent, it certainly makes it a lot easier for us if the case is in this posture.
Sure.
And with that, I guess I would recommend that the commission, I don't know, do you want to take action on these individually, or do you want to have me run through the whole shebang and deal with them?
I think you can go through the whole shebang, and as you're going through them, we can ask questions and discuss them as we proceed.
Okay, that one's a little different in that that's the only one that doesn't pertain to a complainant and a proposed action relative to a complaint. The next two relate to motions to consolidate. The first one is motion to consolidate complaint CT03-011, 012, and 013. These three complaints were all filed by the same company. They all involved the same exact contract, and they were all filed, as you can tell from the number sequence, at approximately at the exact same time. The complainant elected to file a separate complaint. He has three locations, all within South Dakota, and he elected to file three separate complaints because he had the three locations. We've taken the position throughout these proceedings thus far that the operative legal separator, if you will, or definer, are the contracts people had with S&S. These three separate locations, their phone service was prepaid under the same exact contract. It was all under the same billing, and to us at least, it's one action. And that's why we'd recommend consolidating these. The next one is somewhat similar. It involves a little bit of an oddity. Here we have the only situation out of the entirety of the 145 complaints where one of the complainants, and that would be, just a minute here, that would be 120 CT03-126, where the complainant in this particular complaint did not, in fact, have a prepaid contract with S&S. Instead, what the situation was here is because of the names of the people involved, I'm presuming they're related since they all have the same name, but what happened is here is she filed a complaint on her own behalf because her phone service was ultimately, the bottom line here is it was never really connected, is one of the oddities of this thing. It did end up leading to a few hours, at least part of a day, disconnection from Quest due to some issues that developed related to the switchover of her pick and some other things. In the end, what happened is our consumer staff was able to work all that out. She incurred no monetary loss. But her service, her SNS service, was to be provided under the contract that forms the basis of the complaint in CT03-099. Again, as with all the other complaints, were both in the bond proceeding and here, where we've recommended consolidation of those things that arise out of the same contract, we believe that's justified in this case as well. The service for the complainant in 126 was to be provided under the contract in 099. They were the same phone contract, same prepayments. The complainant in 126 did not pay any money to SNS at all. That contract was paid for by the complainant in 099. Next, we'll move along to the first two motions to dismiss, and I'm going to take these. I'm going to take them pretty much in numerical order. The first two have a little bit of anomaly. These are the complaints numbers CT03-073 and complaint CT03-136. The reason I've taken these together is, again, they involve two separate contracts involving two separate companies, but they're two separate companies that have related officers. And what happened here, and if you recall, we did discuss this during the bond proceeding, actually way back in the COA revocation proceeding, one of the key witnesses that we called was the CFO of both of these companies. And at that time, she did testify, even way back then, that these two companies had, in fact, received a full recovery of their prepayment amounts through they paid for them with credit cards, and they received a full recompense from the credit card company on the basis of a credit card insurance program. So they suffered no loss. I called her at the time of the bond proceeding, and at that time, in that telephone call, she told me that they felt they had not been injured, and they wished to have their claims both against the bond and their complaints dismissed. I requested that she confirm that in writing, and she did via an email that I received prior to the bond proceeding. And so basically here we're just doing what those two companies requested that we do, and that's dismiss their complaints.
What about the credit card company and or their insurance provider?
We've never heard a word from them. I actually brought that up at one point with her, and I guess to just look at it, practically speaking, the amount of money here is not a huge amount of money, and I think it's just...
Well, particularly not in this proceeding.
No.
Maybe with the bond proceeding.
With the bond proceeding, but I just think it was below the radar screen, and she said, forget about it. They wanted them to watch. They didn't want to mess with it anymore. You know, she may have had a subrogation obligation to her credit card company. That's possible, but... You know, that wasn't our decision to make. That's a decision those companies made, and that's what they wanted us to do, and we're just doing it here. They've been served with these, and we have not heard any objection.
That was 073 and 136, right?
Yep, 136. Okay. Next, I'll take them in pure motions to dismiss in numerical order, and that's going to jumble them up a little bit in terms of rationale, because there's essentially two rationales for the remainder of the motions to dismiss. The one rationale is, at least our judgment at the staff level, that this commission, in all likelihood, doesn't have jurisdiction to determine complaints involving telecommunications services to be provided in other states. Okay? We have various states involved. We have North Dakota, Montana, California, Nevada. But basically, we took the position that with respect to all service to be provided in other states, those states have commissions, they have courts, and for business that was to be, services that were to be provided in those states, I guess our belief is that it's really getting out there for us to presume that we could adjudicate matters in Nevada. I don't know anything about the law in Nevada. Commissioner Johnson, do you have a question? Or?
Well, and this is, you know, a comment at a county fair years ago, but I think the concerns of those folks is that in some of those states, they don't have, there isn't an entity that plays quite the same role that we do in requiring bonds and making sure that people, even if it's only get dimes, you know, onto the dollars owed. I think that's some of the frustrations for them, some of these folks, but I agree with you from a legal perspective. I mean, what's that matter? If Nevada's not doing its job, it doesn't mean that we're allowed to do their job for them.
Exactly. Yeah, we do have an unusual statute here. I am unaware of another state commission which has a complaint statute like we have. As far as I know, that's a unique animal. But I agree with you, especially with respect to the bonds, for example, and other kinds of security protections and that we put into place. I mean, those clearly were intended to be relate to our COA, which only relates to the provision of service in this state. We're not authorized to allow somebody to provide telephone service in Nevada or North Dakota. And I just think here, again, there's nothing explicit in our statute that says we can't adjudicate matters in another state. But I just think, first of all, there are, and you'll see them in the motion, there are numerous references which do define our regulatory authority as pertaining to the provision of telecommunications services in this state. Just as a practical matter, too. I mean, if you think about it, for us to attempt to adjudicate liability in states where I just have to admit to you, I don't have a clue what the law is in Nevada. You know, I don't know what a company can and cannot do there. And so that's just, again, that's our judgment about this, is that adjudicating matters relating to service in other states is outside the authority of the commission, and we would recommend those services, and again, you're going to see this both with respect to partial motions for partial dismissal and total dismissal, that those be dismissed.
And then, Mr. Smith, let's just identify those so you don't have to repeat that for each one. If you're just talking about to dismiss in their entirety, the services to be offered in other states would take in 138, 141, 143, and 144.
I believe that's correct, yes, sir.
Okay, good.
Is that the totals or the...
Those are the total dismissals,
yes.
That's right.
Now, there are some other ones, too. The dismissal in part, those you'll note up above, and those are...
Mr. Smith, because those are a little more fact-specific,
okay.
You know, maybe we can handle those individually. I just didn't think you probably had to go through that same speech for all of the the dismissal in their entire, for total dismissal.
No, okay, let's go through them. We'll go through the next category, which is, let me see, where am I here, Keith? Okay, why don't we do, okay. Okay, I'm going to do the next two. I'm going to look to are the ones you'll note down and recommend dismissal investments, just to kind of generally explain our thinking, at least with respect to those. Again, it gets down to the breadth of authority that the commission may or may not determine that it possesses. To me, this one's a little closer call than out of state. Again, there's nothing that appears to in any way on its face necessarily limit your complaint authority, at least with respect to 4913-1.1. And again, if you'll note in the motion, it seemed to me at least that section 1.1 probably ought to be read in connection with section 1, 4913-1. In that particular section, that section does clearly make reference to, for quote, violations of Title 49. And that seemed, at least to me, in reading the very, very few case precedents that are out there, court precedents, there's almost nothing. But in at least one of the key cases, which involved a right-of-way issue in Sioux Falls, and this was back in the old Railroad Commission days, before the commission was made up of its current legal structure. But there, at least to me, that case clearly linked the adjudicatory authority under the complaint chapter of the commission with its regulatory reach. And again, it gets down to, again, what the commission, like I say, it's a little tougher case. The cases we're talking about here, and again, the two pure dismissals on this issue, right, are 059 and 061. And at least in our reading of those files, those were loan agreements. Pardon me? Oh, was that what they are? What are these here? Oh, no, those are partials. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Where did I put those? Oh, here. Okay, yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Yep, I had the wrong ones. That's why I have these things here. Those glasses. Yeah, 087 and 133, you'll note, and again, it lays out our particular rationale. It's certainly not a fall-on-our-sword argument that staff's going to make on this. Reasonable minds could possibly differ. But I do think when we get out into areas that have nothing to do with our regulatory reach, we're getting into, we're beginning to skate on pretty thin ice.
Mr. Smith, are you aware of any other instance where the commission has essentially has exercised oversight over investments and securities?
I am not. Not except in those instances which we have some explicit approval authorities with respect to electric.
And so is it opinion staff, at least in 87 and 133, that this is an investment issue and not a telecommunications service issue?
It is absolutely, in my view, not arising out of a contract for telecommunications service.
Thank you.
And again, the legal issues one would look to, the law one would look to resolve these is not to be found in our statutes. We would have to delve into the general commercial law statutes and or securities. And, those are areas where other state agencies have jurisdiction. So, that would be our recommendation at any rate. Now I'm going to move on to, and really substantively in terms of the actual arguments, the remainder of these motions to dismiss in part deal with the same issues. And if you'll note there, right, we have two different sets of them, and you'll see those are CT03040, 059, 083, 083. Those are to dismiss those portions that relate to services to be performed in other states. With respect to the first one, 040, those services were to be performed in Montana. Yeah, along and South Dakota, some portion in both. The next one was to be performed in North Dakota and South Dakota. And the next two, they're all interrelated under the same contract. We split them out because they relate to different locations and subsidiaries. But there we're talking service again in South Dakota for portion of it. And if you want to look for that, that's one of those up top. And which one would that be? Oh yeah, they're all the same docket number. And that's, there was a portion of the service to be provided in South Dakota, the remainder in, North Dakota and Nevada. And the way we, carved that out is we did it based on number of locations. Just real simple. Because we had no data from which we could make a more precise apportionment, for example, say on average number of minutes per annum, or, you know, whatever the basis was. We had no way of doing that. So we just took number of locations, we apportioned the claims between other state and within the state on that basis.
And Mr. Smith, we didn't have that data because it wasn't provided by the complainant, or?
That's right. There's just nothing that, I don't know, and maybe Mr. Singer here would like to give his two cents on that because he did some of that analysis, but I went over it in detail again, in preparation of these documents and this process, and I certainly could not figure out a method to make, to do that any other way. What we have are a bunch of numbers there. It lists no expected call volume over those numbers or anything like that. So we just did it on locations. Okay, and then those are, I think I listed the number, the complaint numbers for those. And then the last category are the recommend dismissal in part. And those are, again, relate to the same complaint, and that's CT03-061. And you'll note we have two line items for that. The reason for that is it relates to two different documents that, in our opinion, are both loan/investment documents. This particular one, the reason it's a dismissal in part, whereas the other two are not, in addition to these two loan documents, in this particular case, this particular complainant did also execute a telephone services contract that had an explicit prepayment amount that was specifically earmarked for the phone service as opposed to a loan. And that, you know, other than the motion for summary disposition, and again, I don't know if you want explanation as to what we did there. Basically what we did is we the calculations are pretty much the same as what we did in the bond proceeding. We started out with original contract amount. We calculated a percent remaining. We applied that to the original contract amount to obtain a contract remaining value. And then you'll note we made a deduction. The big difference between this and the bond case is we did then make a reduction of that amount for bond proceeds received. And you'll note there's at least one little category of complaints that we're recommending approval of, and those are the wireless complaints for service to be provided in South Dakota. They, of course, received no bond proceeds because that was for a state COA, and that didn't cover wireless service. One other significant issue, I guess, I would bring up is the issue of prejudgment interest. Now, I included the statutes on prejudgment interest in the motion, and I'm sure you've read that. The literal language of those prejudgment interest statutes says any award of damages, and so we took the position that means any, and we're given damages award jurisdiction, so we took the position that it's an award of damages and prejudgment interest is appropriate. I at least could find nothing that clearly indicated one way or another whether an administrative agency could or couldn't award prejudgment interest. But again, that's what the statute seems to say. And so we included that. If you're just a word of detail too on how we did the computation. What we did is we calculated the prejudgment interest from, again, the original, I think it was original contract date, is that, or no?
From the date service ended.
Okay, from the date service ended, right, because that's when the date of injury would have begun. From the date service ended until the date of distribution of bond proceeds, which was July 13th is my recollection. And then we recomputed, we computed interest from that day forward, with the principal reduced by the amount of money that they received. The theory being that they would be entitled to present value recovery during that interim period, and at that point then they would have received a sum of money, that then, would reduce the amount of money to which, they would be entitled to earn interest on. And with that, I guess on behalf of the staff, you know, this has been a long, drawn-out process, and we've been through an awful lot on this. I would recommend the commission grant the motions that we've made. If you do that, I would... One last thing, too, is we've requested in here that to plug into the follow-on proceedings in the court that the commission, in its order... specify a date certain by which S&S is to pay the damages that you do decide to award. And that gives us our trigger date then for when we would be able to go into the court and hopefully get this, your order, enforced as a judgment of the court.
And did staff have a recommended trigger date?
You know, if we were talking a situation where we're dealing with a likelihood of recovery here and a company that was in business and solvent and whatever, I would probably recommend, a reasonably, not a lengthy period of time, but maybe 90 to 120 days to allow a company maybe to arrange financing and to make arrangements to be able to actually pay. Because I don't think that that's the case here, I think I would not have an overly long date. My just a gut feeling would be 60 days. But reasonable minds could differ. But again, from conversations I have, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see the damages award paid, and so to me, to prolong this any longer than we have to is there's probably not any reason to do that.
So the only nice thing about not having any money is it doesn't take you very long to count it.
That's right. Yep.
60 days puts us about at December 20th. I would think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, and I mean, let put it this way, too. If S&S or the sole remaining partner against whom we can proceed, Mr. Sumption, you know, if they do want to do something to pay, they're certainly willing to contact us and let us know, and we can come back before the commission if there's anything in the cards in that regard, you know, and get additional time or whatever. That would be our recommendation. I think you can understand the exhibit. I in order to give you the total dollar amount, the total dollar amount, is that on C? Yeah. That we're recommending with prejudgment interest is $767,545.86.
And you said that is with prejudgment interest?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That's prejudgment interest calculated to today. And again, if if you feel it's needed. I mean, we could, we could, I would assume that when we went into the court, we would, carry that calculation forward to the date when an ultimate judgment were entered in this.
Do you know what the per diem interest is?
The, it's a statutory interest rate. It's,
no, I mean, I forgive me. I didn't mean to be ambiguous with my question. The amount that would be accumulating each day that they do not pay this.
Well, it I don't. It's we calculate it on simple interest. It's 10% simple interest, and it calculates right now on.
What's the amount then of the?
It calculates on the basis of 10% per annum simple times $471,890.98.
Thank you.
I mean, I might need Keith to help me figure out that what that would be per day, but
that's fine. I can calculate from there. Thank you. Ms. Weiss, did you have something?
Yes. So it would be fair to say, though, that the commission, if they accept staff's, that we wouldn't need an actual dollar amount with the prejudgment. It would be the damage amount, then the prejudgment interest calculated to whatever date.
Right. You mean to the judgment.
It wouldn't necessarily be the number that you just mentioned.
Not necessarily. We wanted the interest calculated to today so you could see what it was. The one number that, if you believe our methodology is correct, but again, it could be that, you know, the court in the end would want to do something different, but the interest calculation up to the payment date would probably remain the same, because we chop that off as of that date and then reset the principal.
And then when you're talking about the 60 days, it would probably be best to say 60 days from the date of the written order that the commission would issue. Would that be correct?
I think so, yes. And again, that 60, I'm throwing that out. I mean, if you feel that that's unreasonably short, I mean, my other argument in justification of that, though, is, I mean, this isn't like something that's hitting S&S out of the blue. And we've been at this a long time. They know this money is owed. And we haven't seen any movement toward doing anything about it. So it's not a surprise here. So,
Mr. Smith, on the motion for summary disposition on item 5, it states that it excludes from the approved damages award any, and then it lists a series of items that are excluded. Would our proceedings here preempt a party from pursuing any further damages in this arena, in those areas?
It might, except with respect to the dismissals, which, if you'll note, we've requested dismissals without prejudice in all those cases. It's possible that it could, in that we've made this argument here, and there's been we haven't received any notices of dispute or anything, and it could be that this resolves the issue. I will tell you, though, and I'm trying to remember, I think Commissioner Hansen, you were here at the time of the COA revocation hearing. And, you know, I did the examination of the witnesses, the customer witnesses, and we had some talk at that time from them about those kinds of things.
Right.
And in the end, if you'll recall, and I went back and reread some of that, you know, even there, nobody could actually point to anything. You know, nobody could actually point to a customer they had lost or a sale that they had lost or anything else. You know, and our reason for taking this approach is, again, if you look at the legal basis I lay out, is contract damages are meant to be relatively certain in origin and relationship to a methodology of calculation, and we just don't have anything. We don't actually have, that I know of, anyone who pointed and said, I lost this $25,000 sale because of this. We just don't have that. We have more a whole group of people who, all of them experienced one level or another of inconvenience. And obviously if you have a day or some of them, and there were minor differences in length of time they were out of service, in general a day, obviously you're going to have some inefficient performance in a day when you don't have long distance service. And again, I remind you, like, local service was not disconnected. Some of them had alternative communication mechanisms such as cell phones and that kind of thing. And I'm just telling you, there's no actual evidence that I can recall, and I don't know, Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, that offered any concrete basis whatsoever for a computation of a consequential type damages award.
Rather than having any question pertaining to the date 60 days from now, would you, and when it begins, et cetera, could we just say January 1, 2009?
That sounds phenomenal.
Then we don't have to worry about
yep.
people trying to figure out. Thank you.
Yes.
Any further questions at this point?
No, I don't know if I have any questions, just that I think you've done a pretty good job of getting it down to the actual who suffered losses in the state of South Dakota. I think that was my major concern about who was going to get the money, that it stayed in South Dakota, and also that it wasn't someone who had already been reimbursed by an insurance company or actually didn't suffer any damages. So I think this is pretty well bulked out.
Yeah, and I would note, too, that the other deductions we made, of course, you've been through that in the bond proceeding, but we also deducted out those persons who had financed their contracts with financing entities and didn't have to pay those back.
Sure.
If you recall, the one was Aberdeen Finance, where we had that non-recourse agreement.
Yeah.
And then there were two other financing entities where they had used installment sales types contracts, which were either their in-house counsel or through attempts at legal collection actions, those had been determined to not be collectible because of a failure consideration.
I would also agree with you that anyone who loaned this company money it should be no safer than being in the stock market these days. So I don't think they would be eligible for reclaiming of that.
Well, they may have, I mean, I'm not even arguing that. One reason I'm recommending dismissal without prejudice, so we're not making adjudication in that. I'm just recommending they're perfectly free to go attempt to collect their money in court if they want to.
If they were a victim of fraud or.
Sure. Or if they, I mean, they made a loan, the loan wasn't paid back. If they want to go in and sue for a repayment of that loan, for collection on that loan, as far as I know, they'd still be able to do that. They're still within the statute of limitations, I think, as far as I know.
But this isn't the proper recourse.
Yeah, I don't think it is. And again, I'm sure we have very few of them. And, again, that's at least our argument, is that we're awful. We get way out there in those. We're a long ways away from what our particular regulatory authority is here.
Sure.
Mr. Smith, none of the three commissioners have been here for all three acts of this Shakespearean drama, but, as we draw to the conclusion of the third act here, I think it's important to manage expectations, and that is that we don't have any reason to believe that Mr. Sumption has any assets that are going to provide any additional relief to anyone who's on this list.
No, I have no reason to believe that he does.
The most likely outcome of this proceeding is that we will force Mr. Sumption into filing for bankruptcy.
Yes, or at a minimum that he's judgment-proof and we just won't. I don't actually, from what I've, in the searching I've done on a personal level, I am unaware of anything.
I'm not saying he doesn't have assets, just we're unaware of any.
Right, and if you'll recall, and I think I reference it in here somewhere, in the AFC bankruptcy petition. I know it's an exhibit in the AFC file, and you can look at it. in their S&S made a complete assignment, a total asset assignment of all of its assets over to Aberdeen Finance, who in turn all their properties were subject to lien by my recollection is Wells Fargo Bank. And so what happened there is everything they did have passed through that set of transactions and the bankruptcy proceeding into a distribution in the AFC bankruptcy. And basically that meant went to Wells Fargo.
So, you know, my last question for staff would be, I mean, what else? Is this the final expected commission action on these dockets and the entire S&S matter, or is there something more that would need to be done?
No, I'm hoping not. We have received no notices of dispute. We've received no appearance in this thing from Mr. Sumption or S&S. As far as I'm concerned, it's going to be done.
So absent an unexpected filing, this commission should not be dealing with an S&S docket again.
That's correct. Or absent a curveball in the circuit court that I hope we don't have, but that would be it.
Have we secured Mr. Singer's commitment throughout to help with any future S&S items?
Yes. Yes, he said he's available through at least 2015. Yep, you're welcome.
Just to be certain, in case someone was listening on the internet about this, that $767,000 figure that you put, that is not sitting in a, you know.
There's no money.
Exactly.
The money we had, we
somewhere ready to cut a check.
No.
Just so people understand that's just a judgment that
it's a judgment.
We've decided.
Right.
That's a fair value for, but it does not exist.
It does not exist. The
monetary.
Strange things happen.
Yeah.
$1 spent on the lotto could conceivably
and we've
produce,
given him several years to try to raise money that way, but it's
you just never know is all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Once we have a judgment stays in effect for 20 years. It'll be a judgment out there unless he elects to file for bankruptcy protection.
I assume on anybody on the internet thinking that they'd be getting another check in lieu of the bonds.
At this point, no. There we have no monies in our possession. All of the monies that we received were distributed to complainants in July of last year.
Last year, yeah. All right. Thank you.
That's a good point. Well, we have approximately five motions then to deal with. First will be the motion to dismiss with respect to Matt Swearingen because of the discharge on bankruptcy. Is there a motion to that effect?
Yeah, I'll motion to dismiss with respect to Matt Swearingen from the case, from the docket.
Discussion on that motion? Seeing none. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. The Matt Swearingen is dismissed from this. Motion to consolidate CTO 3-011, 012, and 013, as well as consolidation of CT 03-099 and 126. Is there a motion?
So moved.
There's motion discussion. Seeing none, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. Those motions are consolidated. Motion to dismiss in their entirety, and this is without prejudice, the following complaints. CT 03-136, CT 03-138, CT 03-133, CT 03-187, forgive me. Did I say one? Forgive me. I meant to say CT 03-087. I'm glad you folks are following along. And CT 03-073, CT 03-141, CT03-143 and CT03-144. Is there a motion?
So moved. To dismiss in the entirety of those following.
Without prejudice.
Without prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Next item to consider, motions to dismiss in part the following complaints without prejudice. CT03-040, CT03-059, CT03-061, and CT03-083. I will move that we dismiss in part those complaints without prejudice. Is there a discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. Motion carries. We have about a dozen items under the motion for summary disposition, and I will not be reading all of those. We've discussed them here. Is there a motion in that respect? I will make a motion for summary disposition on those items that are listed as 1 through 12 in staff's motion, that under that motion, on item 6, that an aggregate total amount of damages be established at $471,890.98, that the payment, that the prejudgment interest be calculated at 10%, that under item 11, the date certain be established as January 1st, 2009, and that all of the other recommendations, including the computational factors for damages by staff, be accepted. Are there any other specifics that need to be added to that?
I don't think so.
Thank you. Discussion by commissioners. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. I believe that's all that we need to do to deal with this. And knowing that, why didn't you bring us this 5 years ago? Well, I appreciate very, very much, and I'm sure that the other commissioners do as well, the long, hard, arduous work that you folks did. Keith, we especially appreciate you helping with the calculations and coming back and working with and for us here so that we didn't have to prolong this any further and have additional staff person. I'm sure those additional staff people appreciate, too, the fact that they didn't have to try and figure out where A was in order to go to B with this. And thank you all very, very much for sticking with this and arriving at the conclusions. It's just terribly unfortunate that we were not able to discover or uncover a significant additional funds to take care of those folks who were financially injured as a result of this. And I think this goes to the saying that even those most astute business people can be taken advantage of, and we all need to be very, very careful. We worry about those Nigerian scams and that type of thing, but a lot of folks here were seasoned business people who lost significant funds of money, so we all need to be careful. Commissioners, anything else? If not, is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
We have a motion to adjourn. All those in favor, please signify by saying yes. And all those opposed, please signify by saying no. Motion carries.